It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My guest next week is author, columnist, and technologist, and technology historian as well, Stephen Levy. I hope you'll join us then. My guest tonight, Sally Seifer, is a PhD from Cornell University, historian, former college teacher, former town councilwoman and town supervisor of Putnam Valley, New York, former Putnam County, New York historian. She is now deputy county historian there. A United States and world traveler, a very active parishioner of St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Mohegan Lake, New York, a bundle of activity and a good friend of mine. We will take call-ins at the end of the show. The call-in number is 646-716-9756. Good evening, Sally, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here, I think.
We'll see. Let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I was born in Trenton, New Jersey. Trenton makes, the world takes. That was the sign there. And I moved to Bordentown as a child, down the river. And then I went to school at St. Mary's Hall in Burlington, a girls' school. And then I went to Mount Holyoke College. Spent my junior year at St. Andrews in Scotland. Played golf there, but I was terrible. And then I went to graduate school at Cornell and did my dissertation in Scottish history, so I had a chance to go back to Scotland for another year. And
Bordentown is very close to the place I spent one of the most intense 8 weeks of my life, Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Well, yes, we were not far from Fort Dix.
How large was the high school that you went to? You said there was
I had a class of 20.
20?
Yes.
And there was an all-girls religious school, am I correct?
It was an all-girls Episcopal boarding school.
Oh, okay.
Right. And then I went to a women's college.
Okay. Yeah. Aren't Mount Holyoke and Smith the only of the seven sisters that remain all female?
No. Wellesley still is. Bryn Mawr still is.
I thought they'd all changed. I must be incorrect.
Radcliffe is gone.
Okay. Tell us about
Vassar's gone co-ed.
Huh?
And Vassar's co-ed now, of course.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your college experience and the year abroad.
Well, my college experience, I think, was very, well, going to a woman's college was very important for my later life. And I think that I would not have become involved in politics. I would not certainly have gone to graduate school at a place like Cornell. And I would not have got involved in politics in the early days of the women's movement if I hadn't had the confidence that came from having been at a women's college and having had role models that were women and and the feeling that you could do anything you wanted to do. And it was very important for me, and I think it was also important for a lot of women who were involved in politics in the 1970s, and people like, well, in Westchester County, Nita Lowey went to Mount Holyoke. She went to a women's college. Bella Abzug went to Hunter when it was a women's college. And if you look at Ella Grasso, first woman governor in this country, went to Mount Holyoke. And I think women's colleges were breeding grounds of people who later felt confident enough to run for office and what was then a man's world.
That's very interesting. A friend of mine, Dellen Hancock, who was the chairman of the board of trustees at Marist College, and at one time she was the highest ranking woman at IBM, and she was later CEO of Exodus Communications, and she said that when she went to conferences and she met women who were CEOs, the vast majority of them went to all women's colleges. She went to the College of New Rochelle, which is an all women's Catholic college, and I hadn't thought about it like that. I had thought just the opposite, that you wouldn't have the confidence in dealing with men, but apparently it's just the opposite.
Well, when I went to Cornell, although it was co-ed from the get-go 150 years ago, or almost 150 years ago, it was very sexist. The only women with tenure in the whole place outside of the then what was called home ec were a couple of women in modern languages. It was just, and there were no women faculty in the history department, no women faculty in government department.
By the way, you're a little too modest about your colleges. You did mention you have Phi Beta Kappa and you were first in your graduating class. Tell us about the year at St. Andrews.
Oh, well, that was just a ball. I think I did much more Scottish country dancing than spending time in class. And I went with in those days, St. Andrews had very few Americans. And that's over 50 years ago. Now there are lots. But this was soon after the war. Everything was still rationed. Meat was still rationed. Coal was still rationed. We were cold the whole time. But we wore our warm wool red gowns that you wore to class and inside, outside, put them on your bed at night. The food was pretty terrible. And I had the happiest time I had for many years. Just wonderful.
You told me an incident that you had involving the American expatriate and the Nobel laureate T.S. Eliot. Why don't you repeat that to the audience?
Well, students were very irreverent in Scotland in those days, and when they, for instance, they elected the rector. Scottish universities were very democratic. The Lord Rector of the university was elected by the students, and then when he was inaugurated, he went through town in a carriage that was pulled by first-year students. But they also gave, at the time that the rector was inaugurated, they gave an honorary degree to T.S. Eliot. And it was the students' tradition of heaving rolls of toilet paper down on the honoree, which I was sort of appalled at, but, you know, it was a wasteland.
It was the wasteland. Now, was there any mention then? I was reading when I went through an incident, that relationship he had with Groucho Marx, that he was known to being anti-Semitic. Did anyone care at St. Andrews that he had this reputation?
I don't know, because I didn't know it then. I mean, I, of course, learned it later, but I was just dazzled to see T.S. Eliot in the flesh, having struggled through a lot of his poetry, and I mean struggled.
How did you happen to choose Cornell for graduate study?
They gave me the most money.
That's a very good reason. I know you're also Phi Beta
Kappa.
Well,
I was looking for a place that had strong British history, and Cornell did, and I got a fellowship, and I was able and fortunate to be able to go through college and graduate school with no debt, which is just nowadays it's just terrible for people.
That's unheard of.
Yeah.
I know you're also Phi Beta Kappa at Cornell. What was the PhD program like? I know many PhDs, they thought it was very enthusiastic, but find it a real drag during the dissertation period. Was it like that for you?
Well, that part, Cornell was a great deal of fun because the number of graduate students was small. You worked very closely with your committee, the chair, and the faculty who were on your committee, so that we knew them very well. We were their teaching assistants, and it was a much closer relationship than one had if I'd gone to Harvard or Yale. So I was very happy there, and I was able to do my dissertation in Scottish history, so I got to go back to Scotland.
A friend of mine's daughter went to law school there, and perhaps it was different when you were there, but the law building, because of the weather, had the dormitory for the law students. It had all the classrooms, and then it had a cafeteria in it. So if there was bad weather, they never had to leave the building. So.
Well, we had to leave the building. On the other hand, the weather was terrible, and it often was. We took trays from the cafeteria and slid down the slope, the live slope down from the library, which was excellent.
One of the early snowboarders.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been married even longer than I have. When did you meet your husband, Wiley, and when did you get married?
We met in the Andrew D. White European History Library at Cornell. He was doing 16th century. I was doing 16th century. And we married in 1958. And in those days, of course, he had to get the job first, and he went to Hunter in New York City. So then I had to find a job in New York City. Those were not particularly good years for finding jobs, but they're certainly better than it is today. And so I taught at Bronx Community College and could walk to work. And he chose later to be in the Uptown campus of Hunter, which later became Lehman College, and he taught there his whole academic career.
What made you choose Putnam Valley as a permanent home?
We couldn't afford Westchester. Simple as that. We moved to the Bronx and lived there for 3 years, but both of us came from small towns, and we were not happy living in New York in the long run, and we decided it was time to have some children. And we moved out.
Were you politically active during the college and undergraduate days, or was the Putnam Valley experience new to you?
No, okay. This was new, and it was, at a certain stage of my life, I became active in a local League of Women Voters, which is the way virtually my entire cohort got active in politics. And the League was very... it was a training ground for all of us, and it was very good in local affairs. It was not so great in national or international affairs. But when it came to local governments and keeping an eye on your local town board or local board of trustees or whatever, it was wonderful. And the men who were sitting on the boards couldn't believe anybody was watching them, and the League was watching them, and the League was noticing when they would go and have a town board meeting in somebody's house and the kinds of things that we later were able to get changed in New York City.
That was
our training ground. After a while, the problem was, in League you had to study everything to death before you took a position. And that became kind of frustrating because when you'd see something that should be changed, you had to study it first before the League would take a position.
Now, why does the League no longer exist in Putnam County or in Putnam Valley?
Well, I know why it didn't exist. In Putnam Valley, if you or your husband were elected to any public position or appointed to any board, so if a husband or you went on the school board or went on the planning board or to the town board, you couldn't serve on the board. And our league put one person after another on boards. And it was the victim of its success, in a way. And pretty soon there was not much reason. We couldn't find people to serve on the board. And then the problem was, of course, more and more women went back to work. I mean, working full time. When I started the league, I had small children at home, and I was not working.
I know that at one point you were on the Democratic State Committee and that you went to the 1974 Democratic Mini Convention. Would you describe those times and activities for us?
Well, that was very exciting for me to be involved with a lot of really amazing women who all went to this mini convention. We had worked for Marianne Krupczak, who ran for lieutenant governor in New York State. Now you say lieutenant governor, that's a non-job. But in those days, to get a woman elected lieutenant governor was very exciting. And we ran her campaign here in Putnam County, her primary campaign, and she was running against two men, Tony Olivieri and Mario Cuomo. And she beat them both in Putnam County, as well as, of course, she beat them in the state. And it was an exciting time. So I got to go to the mini convention as a delegate she chose, and then I saw all these people that I admired, so people like Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm and that group, wonderful people.
Now, was she the choice of Hugh Carey, or did he leave it up to the convention?
No, she wasn't the choice. She won the primary.
Did he have another choice? Did he endorse anyone?
I can't remember whom he chose or whom he supported.
I don't believe he did.
That she wasn't his.
I know you're a councilwoman and later town supervisor. Many of us are familiar with big city politics, mayors and the like. Could you describe the duties of these positions?
Well, in council, it's a legislative position. And that's after 8 years I found somewhat frustrating, partly because we had a supervisor who was not paying the bills. And so we ended up when he left, with a huge debt and had to go to the state legislature to get permission to bond a deficit, which we paid off in 4 years instead of five when I was supervisor. And the supervisor job is interesting because it's a kind of a combination, both legislative and executive. And you're the chief fiscal officer.
But the
jobs of town government, it's really, with few exceptions, it is nothing ideological. It's not conservative or liberal. It's dogs and garbage and that kind of thing, and potholes. And you learn a lot about berms and swales and solid waste and wastewater and all those things that are not usually anybody's cup of tea, but are very important for everybody's daily life.
You know, I know that the present town supervisor in Putnam Valley, who we both know, says it's a nice place to live and that you don't have these battles that some town councils do. Now, I know there's been some heavy battles in the town of Yorktown, but Putnam Valley seems exempt from that a bit, huh?
Well, it has not always been so, and I think if there was anything that I brought to Putnam Valley's politics, which had been very contentious, and public hearings had been nobody had hit anybody, but very nasty. And I think partly because I had a background in history and in putting material together, I could take a public hearing and lay out the pros and cons of the issues to help diffuse issues from blowing up. And I used to say I like to bore people to death, but I think I did run a pretty good public hearing, and I think it helped to calm the waters at a time when the waters needed calming very much.
Do you see that as your best achievement as town supervisor, or can you put your finger on something else that was specifically important to you?
I think we did, beside bringing some fiscal sanity to the town and trying to bring some civility that had been sorely lacking, we also did manage to do some good environmental legislation, some good wetlands legislation. I think we made some very good appointments to the planning board. We got a good accessory apartment law, which has worked very well. And it didn't get everything we wanted, but I think it was a credible job.
You were town supervisor.
And I'm not saying just me. I mean, yeah. I had a wonderful town board.
You were town supervisor for four terms and then chose not to run again. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think you do a good job when you're enjoying it. And I just suspected that down the pike I wasn't going to be enjoying it and I might not do such a good job. And I thought it was better to, as I say, get out before the voters got wise.
At the conclusion of your tenure of town supervisor, you became historian for Putnam County, and the following year became the president of the New York State County Historians. How did you happen to move into those duties?
I just, lucked out. It was a job made in heaven for me. I had become through the local historical society very interested in local history, and particularly in the history of mining in Putnam County. And I had grown more and more interested in that kind of nuts and bolts sort of history, not the stuff I had done in the 16th century. And when this job came along, and Jim Gordon, who was on the county legislature and briefly its chairman, asked me if I'd serve. I first said no, and then I said yes. And I just loved it. But my husband retired from teaching in 1992, and I was beginning to think, well, I wanted to spend more time doing things with him while we can do it. So in 96, I retired as county historian, and I have continued to serve as the deputy county historian since then, and enjoyed that too.
I've never heard
a lot of traveling.
I only had one contact with him, but I've never heard anyone say a bad thing about Jim Gordon. Do you know the story of his career as a baseball announcer?
Baseball.
Yeah, he was terrific. He was a terrific hockey announcer.
Hockey and football, I didn't know.
And
baseball.
He also had done some basketball, but he got a call one day that the announcer for the Philadelphia Phillies was ill, and could he take his place at the Met-Philly game? And he did, and that was Jim Bunning's perfect game.
Never told me that.
And he said he never had another thing. Well, the person told me that, who was a friend of his, who used to have, he may still have the business, in a baseball card and comic book store in Mohegan Lake. Mm-hmm. And I had occasion to call Gordon out of the blue. A friend of mine was a professor at in Hawaii, and she had the football played in class. She was responsible for the people who came from the mainland too, and the freshmen. And he developed the same kind of cancer that the giant tackle Carl Nelson had. That he was extremely depressed apparently, and the football coach was trying to lean on him to take the year off to heal, but then he wouldn't have had any of the healthcare benefits that he had as being on the team. So he was depressed by the whole thing, and I thought it would be good if he could talk to Nelson, and I called Gordon out of the blue, and I told him the story, and he immediately gave me Carl Nelson's home number. And then he also verified that perfect game story, and he said, what else could I do, you know? I that was the one major league game he ever called. And I called Nelson, who was also extremely interested, and he wound up calling the young man in Hawaii, and I think that he had, from what I understand, that he had an impact, and he cheered the person up. If you may remember, he had the cancer. Then he was able to go back to playing for the Giants after 2 years, and then he eventually retired. Then he became Gordon's broadcasting partner with Dick Lynch. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting.
Yeah. Jim.
Now,
was
obviously, if you had been involved as the county historian or the deputy for 24 years, you still feel there's a lot to be found out about Putnam County. What has held your interest for so long?
What, in Putnam County or history?
Historian in Putnam County, yeah.
Oh, well, because it's a job that's now being deputy. See, now I don't have to go to department meetings, and I don't have to make up the department budget. I don't have to do any of the things I didn't much love, and I can do historical research, and I can work in the archives in arranging, describing collections, and I can go try to get hold of some collections. And I can help researchers with their, various struggles with the records. And what could be more fun?
That's great. You've also been active in many other community activities and the plethora of conferences, committees, and councils. Can you tell about some of these?
Well, most of the things that I've been involved with are state committees to establish policies for record keeping and in the state. And for instance, the state Historical Records Advisory Board. Every state in the country has to have a state records advisory board, and they do things like when archives and historical agencies apply for a grant to the federal government, to the state, to national archives, we review those grants and say yes, no, and review them and establish what we think collecting policies ought to be throughout the state, and try to do things to encourage smaller agencies to make sure that their collecting is done in a professional manner, and that their records are accessible. It doesn't do any good to save a lot of paper if it's not taken care of and made accessible to the public. You might as well just burn it.
The close friend of mine who was one of your constituents, Jim Casey, who I told you had gotten into stained glass, and he's writing about it, and he went to France and he did some study there. He's going to be exploring the archives of the Archdiocese of New York, which is held at Dunwoody, and I wonder, if they're in good shape or if we're just going to be plowing through paper. But he's looking for information on the stained glass, on a particular stained glass windows that are in Barrytown, New York. So Speaking of churches and stained glass windows, I mentioned earlier that you've been an active member of St. Mary's Episcopal Church for some time. St. Mary's is far from a new parish. Could you tell us some of the history of St. Mary's, including the origin of the Tiffany windows?
Well, there are three windows in the nave that were given in the 1890s by someone who'd been the organist there, whose name I don't remember, but it's right there on them, I should remember. And then the window that is over the altar, the very interesting window of the Madonna with children, which I think is exceptionally beautiful. And that dates from 1926. But they're all Tiffany Studio. The church was founded, actually, by a group of men who met in a tavern in Yorktown and decided that there was a need for an Episcopal church. And the church was built in 1876. So it's just had it's going to have a 150 very soon.
It's just built
in the style of an English country church.
I thought that Mother Claire Woodley, the director, had mentioned that the three windows, they were the pictures of them in it were of people
faithful
in the field.
Charity.
Yeah, but the pictures themselves, they were pictures of women in the field family. Have you heard
that?
Well,
I never heard that.
Okay.
And the article I saw in one of the newspapers about those windows did not mention that. But
okay.
She knows more about it than I do.
Okay. Switching a bit more, I know that you like to explore old and used bookstores. I'm a book lover, too, and have more books than a medium-sized Barnes & Noble. But I only like new books. The Strand, for instance, it confuses the heart of me. What's the pull of old bookstores?
Oh, how can I... Well, I guess it's like traveling. It's so many books, so little time. I will never, I think, want to read a book on a Kindle. I just like the feeling of the paper and to go back and forth. We were just in Maine this last week and spent a good deal of time in a wonderful secondhand bookstore in Wells, Maine, and I have them all marked on my map where all the good ones are.
Now, is your interest still mainly history, or do you read novels?
No. Oh, it's history and fiction.
Okay.
Both history and fiction. And right now, my husband and I are reading everything we can about Sicily, because we're going to Sicily next month.
Okay. The Godfather's home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Did Wiley continue with the history interest during his teaching year? Did he teach history?
Oh, yes, he taught history. He taught mostly Renaissance and Reformation, and then when the college changed a lot and after it opened admissions, Renaissance and Reformation seemed somewhat irrelevant to most of them, and he kind of gradually shifted to teaching World War I and World War II, and that's his main interest now, and that's what he reads extensively in now, beside fiction.
That's interesting. The World War II history, and I suppose that the Korean War in Vietnam will have the same pull to people in 20 or 30 years as we get a bit away from it. You know?
Right, right.
The politics.
We were children in the in the Second World War.
Yeah. But I mentioned earlier that you, Dan Wiley, have traveled a lot, and you just mentioned going to Sicily, both within the United States and abroad. Would you tell us of some of your past and future places on your itinerary and tell us any memorable incidents along the way?
Well, for a while, we did, when we had more muscle and were younger, we did a lot of wilderness canoe camping in Canada particularly. And I mean wilderness. And we'd go off for a couple of weeks with friends. And it was very exciting. But as you get older, you have to worry a little bit about health and those trips. And since then, we have been we've taken a lot of what used to be Elder Hostel and now is Rhodes Scholar, and we've done trips to the High Arctic, and this trip to Sicily will be Rhodes Scholar. We've also gone on non-Rhodes Scholar trips like to Norway and Palau, and I've never been to Asia, and I've never been to Africa, so I can hardly be called a world traveler, but I'd like to.
And you've also been recently to Pacific Northwest, and you seem to go up and down the East Coast.
Oh, yes.
Quite
well,
a bit regularly.
We travel a lot in the United States, and we have friends who used to live in Putnam Valley who live in Oregon, and they're very compatible people to travel with. It's very hard to find other people to travel with that you really, you know, mesh with. And these are good friends that will go somewhere probably in September with them.
My wife Barbara's been to Africa. It's a funny story. It was long before we were married, and she stayed in a hotel at a canyon that William Holden owned part of. And 30-some years later, my children stayed in the same hotel by coincidence. So, you also told me a story, and I'm sure there are many stories that you have from your travels, but you told me a story about one of your favorite people, Bach, and where you happened to be on one of his anniversaries.
Oh, oh, I just told you that this morning.
Yeah.
We were in Paris. We used to go to Paris in January, which is a crazy time to go to Paris. But my husband would have a break, and we would go do research, and I could take, that was when I would take my vacation from Town Hall, and we would go do research, and I would keep my hand in history. But one year we went in March, and we were there in March for the 300th anniversary for the birth of Johann Sebastian Bach. And at the church right around the corner from where we always stay in Paris, Saint-Germain-des-Prés, they were having a wonderful concert of the St. John Passion. And there was a small Baroque orchestra and a wonderful choir. And at the end, the final chorale, everybody stood and sang it. And people sang it in the language that they were used to from their homes, because there are people from all over Europe there. And after that, the organist went up to the big organ at the church and belted out the chorale again. And I tell you, there was not a dry eye in the place. It was so moving. Because we were singing and sort of weeping at the same time. It was so beautiful. But I'm a Bach nut, so, you know.
Do you have any other...
And I cry at supermarket openings, so.
Do you have any other stories like that that happened during your travels that you'd like to share?
Well, there was one time we went to a small library in France. We were looking for some particular pamphlets that had been published in the 16th century, and we thought that this Institute of France would have them. So we went into this place. It was very hard to find. But we went into this place, and there was a man at the door wearing the bleu de travail, the blue smocks that French guards used to wear. And we walked in, went past him, no problem. And we looked in the card catalog. That's when places still had card catalogs. And there was about a 5-watt bulb, so we had to take the drawers out over to the window. And in full view of this guard, we put the card catalogs back and but they didn't have what we were looking for. So we started to leave, and he said, we can't leave. We said, why not? And this is a Friday afternoon. And he said, because you don't have a laissez-passer. You don't have an exit permit. So I said, well, we've been right here in front of you all this time. Where do we get an exit permit? He says, well, you get it when you return a book. I said, but we didn't use a book. This is all in French. And he said, well, you have to go see the librarian. So we went into the librarian. It's this wonderful 17th century room with big oak chairs and everything. And there's this dragon woman at the desk. And I have to go ask her for a laissez-passer. And she said, well, you haven't returned a book. I said, but we didn't get a book. And she said, well, you only get a laissez-passer when you've returned a book. So Wiley says to me, okay, we'll get a book. And then she says, you can't get a book. It's 3:45 on Friday afternoon. So I'm throwing myself on this woman's mercy. I have this vision of being locked in this wonderful French library all over the weekend, trying to call the embassy, saying, get me out of here. But anyway, she finally relented, and she gave me this lecture, and en principe, in principle, madam, you must never do this again. I mean, it was just craziness, you know, that's French regulations. That was just, you know, funny.
That's very strange, French.
Yeah.
Back to a mutual friend, Jim Casey. He was in France doing research during October, and he went to the town that the artisan who had done these stained glass windows lived, and he was looking for information there. They had an archive or whatever, and he asked someone. He said, "Where could I find information about whoever the artisan was, the stained glass window maker?" And they said, "Well, why don't you go ask your grandson? He lives two blocks away." So he went to the grandson, and there were plaques there, and there were stories there. So it was one of these very, very lucky things. Who's the person fluent in French? You or Wiley, or both?
Well, I'm more. Though every time I go back, I've been away, and I have to kind of warm up again. You know, it's away from it.
Okay. All right.
I minored in French in college.
Oh, you did? Okay. We have a caller. Let me plug him in. Hello, caller. Who are you and where are you calling from? Hello? Caller from 914-528-2864?
Oh, John, that's me. This is Lorraine. I'm glad to hear all about Sally's goings on, and I'm glad she didn't get stuck in the library and couldn't come back to us.
Hi,
Lorraine.
Hi, Sally. I just got to say I enjoyed listening. Did know a few things that you said about yourself and all, but not everything, and it was very interesting.
Oh, good.
Do you have any? Do you have any questions about anything else you said?
Lorraine, we used to say delightful if true.
Yes. So it was very interesting. But I have no questions.
You have no questions?
No.
And I used
to... Anyway, I'll see her tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yes, hopefully, if it doesn't snow bad.
Are you still active politically at all, Sally?
No.
Okay.
No.
No strong feelings or out campaigning for anyone in the comments?
Oh, yes, of course I have strong feelings. But I send money, and that's what I do.
Okay. All right. What else would you like the audience to know about Sally's life that we haven't gotten into?
Oh, my goodness. I'm nonplussed. I can't think of any job.
How many children do you have?
Oh, my children, yeah. I have two children. We have two children. Our son teaches 8th grade science in Wilmington, Delaware, and he has four children. The oldest one is about to go to college, and the youngest is 13. And then I have a daughter who is a software engineer, and She has two children, and she lives outside of Boston.
She's with one of the tech firms off 128.
She's with a tech firm, right? She's with a tech firm, and she does all kinds talks to. She has engineers in different countries that she manages. So she manages engineers in India and I don't know where else, you know, which is all totally beyond me.
Well, that's something that the internet gave us, and it was completely hyper pushed during the concern about 9/11 when there weren't that many programmers here and that could solve the problem, because many of the people who created the problem were retired. They brought back ones who were retired, who they could find, but the Indians came to the United States and he said, we can do this, and they took a chance and they found that we could offshore much programming after that worked out. Anything that was non-sensitive for intelligence or for investigative outfits, and much of the programming has been offshored. IBM has big installations in India and they send a lot out, and it's very interesting, and it's also difficult. When I was first teaching back in the 90s full time to students at Monroe College, all I had to do was to walk down Wall Street with the big sign, IT graduate, and then be grabbed off the street. 20 years later, those same kind of people aren't getting jobs in the United States. So they have to adapt to all of the new things that we do. You always have to be ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. So it must be very interesting for her, because the trick is to manage all these foreign people. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, she also finds it's difficult because she works for a French company, and they have an approach that things have to be done by the certain methods, and she finds that they want to have the back office in India. If they've got a problem, they have to talk to the front office, and then the front office talks to the front office here in this country, and then the front office talks to the back office, and then she finds she can't talk directly to the people with the problem because it's got to go through some crazy system. Or as I heard somebody say, it works in practice, but it will work in theory, and that's the way sometimes some companies function.
To manage, yeah.
But she loves it.
Well, that's good. That's...
She loves her work.
And both of them started
out, probably went to college when they shouldn't have been in college yet. Both of them managed to do badly their first year, then got their act together and went to Westchester Community College, and then went on to four-year colleges and did brilliantly after that. But they both said that they had excellent teaching at Westchester.
My wife teaches there, and I taught there there years ago before I went back to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. It's the stepping stone. And Joe Hankin, who recently retired as the president, is a very nice man and a very concerned person. He was the president of the school for longer than any president of a community college in the United States. Then he'll be my guest in the late spring or in the early summer.
Well, both of them said that they had the best teaching there they had before or after.
And what science, when you said your son, the science teacher, was he the science major or was he an education major? What was his field?
Science major. But he's teaching eighth grade, so he's teaching earth science primarily, but he's won all kinds of awards for being a great teacher, and I can tell he is.
Terrific.
And I'm not very proud of him. No.
A final question. You're the only Sally that I know that's an IE rather than a Y. How did that come about?
That's the way my grandmother spelled it.
Okay.
And that's the way her grandmother spelled it.
Have you ever met...
And I'm not Sarah. I'm not Sarah. I'm Sally.
Have you ever met another one who spelled it like that?
Sally Krawcheck. I never met her, but she's...
Okay.
A CEO somewhere.
Okay.
I've known a few other Sallys, i.e. Sallys. But it's my grandmother came from North Carolina, and it's, I guess, more common down there to have that spelling.
I.E.'s, yes, I imagine.
Oh, I hated my name. You know, you do as you're a child, but I grew to like it.
I like it. I think it fits. Well, thank you very much. It's been a tremendous pleasure.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Bye, John. We'll see you.
Okay. Thank you again, Sally. And in the words of Met radio announcer, Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in a book.
Okay. Let's not hold our breath.
Tune in.
This year will be better.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Tune in next week to my conversation with Sadiq Levy. And till then, as they said in the old neighborhood, see ya. Bo Silver. Steady Silver.